grab it, hold it tight, they will try and escape.
If you want to grab the escape.
Say again?
Where do you want to see them taken? Grab the
seat. I didn't say take them anywhere, I said just grab them, hold them. Thank you. All right. Our guest, the international guest of honour who is speaking here today is Richard Morgan. For those of you, and I don't imagine there are very many who aren't familiar with Richard already, he stormed onto the scene in 2002 with his debut novel Altered Carbon, has rapid-fired off four more science fiction novels, the most recent science fiction novel of his being The Black Man, also known as 13, which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award, I believe it was, and has just published his first fantasy, a dark fantasy novel called The Still Remains. Now, I'm going to start recording now and hand over to Richard.
Wow. This is almost certainly one of the biggest audiences I've ever stood in front of. Okay, so was anyone at Stirling Library a couple of days ago? Oh, for you. No, okay, that's good. So I can do the whole thing all over again. what I usually do with these things is I have a sort of a little preamble to warm people up, but this is my second panel today. I was in a panel there, in fact, and it seems that Australians don't need much warming up. We had our first question from the audience, I think, about 10 seconds into the session. So I'm going to see how we go with this. But I thought I'd give you the preamble anyway, mainly because I don't know if there are any people here who are writers, aspiring writers especially. I mean, people who are still looking to get published. Are there any aspiring writers here, writers who are out there trying? Yeah, one over there, three over there. Excellent. Okay, so that's my excuse to give you to tell you this story. And I think I'll sit down because this feels a little uncomfortable. Can everyone, if I don't speak up loudly enough, let me know, obviously. Right, so I thought I'd tell you the story of how I wrote Altered Carbon, because it really was a bit of a strange change for me. I spent 14 years not getting published. I think that was mainly because I wouldn't write what people told me that I ought to be writing. Maybe because the market changed as well. But anyway, I first put Altered Carbon together in the early to mid-90s. I actually finished it in spring of 97 when I was living in Spain. And I was so pleased with it, I finished it off and then started sending it out. And I sent it out to everybody. You know, all the agents that handled SF, all the publishers that I thought might publish me, absolutely everybody. And of course, what you do, you don't send the whole manuscript out, you just send out a sample. So I sent it out. And to almost everybody, and almost everybody came back saying, oh, yeah, this is really good, let's see the rest of it. Now, I should say at this point that the way I write is not very efficient. It's not a method of writing I'd recommend necessarily, in that it's fairly organic and I tend to back up quite a lot. So rather than mapping the book out and then writing it, I'll be writing a couple of chapters and then build up on that, go back, revise the couple of chapters I've already written, go a little bit further forward, come back, revise the newest bits and so forth. So there's a process of going back over my own paces and polishing. So the result of that was that the novel was quite uneven. And the first 50 pages were pretty damn good because they had been polished to a high gloss. Sadly, this was less true of the back end of the book. So anyway, as I said, I sent it out to almost everybody, and almost everybody came back and said, yeah, this is really good, send us the rest. So I sent the rest to almost everybody, and everybody came back and said, nah, send us the next thing you write. Wow, I was really upset about that. And as I said, I did send it to everybody, so it was a process that went on from the spring of 97 all the way through that year. And I got to the end of 97, and I think that was the point, because I'm quite stubborn. Got to the point at which I realised that maybe they were right, and that there was something wrong with this. And it didn't take a genius to see that what was wrong with it was wrong with the back end of it rather than the front end. So I took it away on the summer of 98. I got a month's holiday in Spain at that time, most people did. Went down south and went with my wife, and we stayed at my wife's grandmother's place on the coast. And while she and the entire family went off and had a really good time, I sat in the kitchen and I ripped the novel apart, took out everything that seemed self-indulgent, everything that seemed superfluous. I rewrote the bits that I thought were shaky. I repolished, I rejoined things. I really, 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 really ripped it apart. Put it back together in what I thought was a much better form, but I felt the polish was pretty even throughout. And I sent it out to everybody again. You can guess how pleased they were to see it the second time. I got a few snappish replies saying, yeah, we've already told you we don't want this. Why are you sending it again? No, but it's really... and rather crestfallen, I came back to the UK, pretty depressed, and shelved the book. When I got back to the UK, I found that there was one place I hadn't tried, which was Virgin. Virgin had a science fiction imprint, paperback science fiction imprint. And so it was my wife who actually found this and said, oh, you should send it to him. So I got my letter together and I sent it out, and they wrote back and said, oh, yeah, the first 50 pages, this is really good, send us the rest. I sent the rest out. I got back a letter really quite fast, about 3 weeks later, guy saying, this is great, we really like this book. Unfortunately, the Virgin science fiction imprint has been frozen. So it's in question if we'll ever publish anything again. But if we do, we would love, this would be the first book we put out there. In the meantime, you should try to place this with somebody else. Yeah, I've been trying to, because it's, you know, it should see print. So, wow, that letter, I photocopied it about 1,000 times. And then I sent out the manuscript a third time with this letter appended, saying, I know you've seen this twice before, but please have a look at what this nice man from Virgin has written, and maybe you'd like to give it a third go. And finally, I got a literary agent who wrote back and went, oh, all right then, but you'll have to pay me for postage. And she took 60 quid off me in advance, aunt, for postage. And at the point at which I realised she'd be a very good agent to have. She has been very sharp with me, I've got to say. Anyway, yes, yeah, so she took me on. And this is the, you know, the first rule of writing club is get an agent. And the second rule of writing club is get an agent. She took me on in May of 2000. I had a 3-book deal by November. Just like that. So yeah, get an agent. One, because obviously, you know, they know what they're doing. Also because you're getting a degree of insider knowledge, the industry. Because when she took me on, she said, okay, so who have you sent this book to? Well, everybody. She said, yeah, but specifics, come on, who did you send it to? She said, okay, I sent it to John so-and-so at Millennium. She goes, yeah, well, he doesn't work there anymore. So that's probably sitting in the slush pile. Who else did you send it to? Miriam, somebody else at somewhere else. Yeah, she's on maternity leave, so that hasn't been read either. Who else do you send it to? Jeff, somebody else. Yeah, he's dead. There's a very good chance he hasn't read that. Yes, and this is how she got me my book deal so very, very fast, because she was obviously plugged into the industry. And in fact, I think it was her first port of call who took me. I think she went straight to Galanz, straight to Simon Spanton at Galanz, because she thought this would be his speed. And yet, it was picked up just like that. So, I don't know if there are any morals to the story, but I guess I can draw a couple. One is, as I said, get an agent. The other is, don't give up. Is it, like I said, third time around before I finally got taken seriously. And the fourth one, I think... Fourth one? That's the third one, isn't it? I think the other thing is that you have to develop a self-critical sense. And it's a difficult thing to do, because you've got to be self-critical and at the same time believe in yourself. And as you'll know, if you've been banging away at this for any length of time, it's very hard to maintain the faith in yourself when you're not getting published, when you're getting rejected the whole time. But you do have to balance that out with a sense of objective reality about what is actually any good. Because I think Alter Carbon in its original form just was not good enough to be published, and I probably could have spent the next 5 or 6 years of my life trying to get it published, probably would never have seen print. So I think there is a point at which you have to be able to step back from your work and ask yourself if it's any good. So those would be my words of advice for anyone who is out there still trying. Now, The other thing that I should mention is that while I was trying to get published for those 14 years, I had to pay the rent with something. So what I did was I taught English as a foreign language. I don't know if anyone does that, do they? Ah, you lucky people. Yeah, and one of the things about teaching English is that you're trying to get a group of people in a room to speak English, which is not their language, which means you have to build their confidence up. And generally speaking, if a teacher is talking, the students won't talk. So what you learn when you're trained in this is you learn to decenter the classroom. And you're sort of told, push it out, take down the authority figure of the teacher, get out of the way so that the students themselves can actually use the language. You set up tasks so that they can speak together or speak to you or whatever. But that's the idea, you're supposed to decenter. So that puts me in a slightly awkward position now, because I'm up here at the front of the classroom, as it were, and I'm talking, and all I can hear is my trainers from 15 years ago, my ELT trainers, saying, shut up, shut up, shut the fuck up, let them talk. And yet it does make me uncomfortable. So I'm hoping that you're going to do the heavy lifting today. I'm hoping that you're going to grill me, and that I will be able to talk to you in terms of answers to questions that you have. It always has struck me a bit, you know, that going to an event like this and coming with a preset spiel isn't that productive, because people will not necessarily want to hear what I think they might want to hear. They've probably got a better idea of what they'd like to hear themselves. So what I'm going to hope is that you are all going to provide me with questions. Now, ordinarily, I would have front-loaded this and asked you to come up with the questions before I gave you the story about the publication. But as I said, I've noticed that Australians seem a lot more comfortable with just coming out with these questions. So I'm going to now turn this over to you, and I'm hoping that there's enough out there that you want to hear me talk about that you'll be able to feed me. And if you are uncomfortable, you of course can get into small groups or pairs to prepare. So does anybody have a question? Or
Richard, you said that you were very stubborn, and that's why you went back and polished your novel. Do you think if you had been more accepting, do you think you would have ditched that one and tried again with something else?
Yeah, I mean, that would have been the smart move, yeah. I think, yeah, I had an interesting experience about a year after I was published. I got nominated for an award, which I didn't win. And while I was there, I met a bunch of other writers in other disciplines who'd also been nominated for this set of awards. And there was one guy there who wrote mainstream sort of pop fiction. And he told me that his process was, think up a novel, write the first 50 pages and a synopsis, send it out to agents or publishers, and if he didn't get any positive response, dump it and start from scratch all over again. And he had written like 4 or 5 of these start-up novels. And finally, that's the interesting thing, is it does work, because he finally got an agent who said, yeah, I like what you're doing here. This is not the one. Go away and write me something else. So in total, he actually put together 5 novels before he even finished one. And it was very interesting, because it was a totally alien mindset. I could not envisage how you would do that. You know, I was so wedded to Altered Carbon, I couldn't possibly have just dumped it and thought of doing something completely different. But he did, and it worked for him. So, you know, yeah, the smart move would be, you know, listen to people in the industry, because they may know what they're talking about. You know, if you're being told that your style is too disjointed and your short stories are too compacted, then, well, that might be true. You know, and so yeah, sure. Stubbornness helps as an author, because it keeps you there when a lot of people just say, sod it, I'm going to go and work in banking. Not so much these days. but at the same time, yeah, the stubbornness can be your worst enemy. Can get in your way, and I do suffer from it as a disadvantage as well as an advantage.
It's a disadvantage or an advantage?
Oh, it's just one of those things just stuck with. It's like my nose, you know. Some days I like it, some days I don't. You are the way you are. I'm increasingly, talk about genetics later, because it's in a couple of the books. I think the older I get, the more I realise that it's very hard to change quite a lot of the sort of intrinsic attitudes and ways of being that we have. And I think there are some that are so deeply rooted that you can't change them. You can monitor them, you know, and try to modify them enough that they don't get in the way. But in the end, I don't think you can change it. I can't stop being stubborn. It's just not going to happen. I just won't. Did that get the question for you?
Yeah.
I've got a much more basic question.
the main character in Altered Carbon, how do you pronounce his first name?
Oh, okay, that's easy. Okay, can we have a vote on this? First name, sorry, or second name?
First name.
First. Oh, right, okay, no, that's
full
easy.
Name.
Takeshi. Takeshi. I know with a Japanese accent, I, you know, which I can't do. Takeshi. Takeshi and... No, sorry, I thought... I presupposed you were talking about Kovacs, which...
No, no, Takeshi. See, for me, you said, like, he's a very friendly person. Kovacs was a chip.
Yeah.
And then I was like, how do you say person?
I'm pretty sure it's Takeshi. The stress pattern might be different, but I think that's right. I don't know. Is anyone...
Takeshi.
Hmm? Takeshi. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Ah, okay, is that right then?
Takeshi, short bell sound.
Short bell sound, Takeshi. Okay, there you go, yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes,
there's a teensy little bit of
lawlessness
in some of
your
books.
A little bit.
Do you have any personal background in martial arts training, or just how did you do
your
research?
Like a lot of things that I know, I have a tiny little bit of knowledge, which I have extrapolated beyond all reasonable measure. I did study martial art, a karate form called Kyoshindo, when I was at university. Kyoshindo is quite an interesting one from a martial arts point of view, because it is karate, but it's very much based in circular moves, and it has a lot to do with evasion and transference of force. It has a lot in common with Aikido, for example. The idea that instead of just meeting with linear force, you're actually attempting to steer the fight. And I found it very engaging. It was also because I was at a university. The people who were teaching me and the people who were studying with me were all students, and so there was an intellectual approach to the, you know, we were interested in the why as well as the how. I quit because I moved to London and I couldn't find a dojo that had that mentality. It was hard to find a Kyoshindo dojo, but also in London the mentality at most dojos was, yeah, you get in and you hit these people really first. And I went to a couple of clubs and basically spent the evening punching posts, you know, and... So I quit. So I had an initial amount, I had about 2.5 years of training, plus quite a good theoretical base on, you know, what makes martial arts tick. And then I've just got to, you know, whenever I see an article or something, I'll pick it up. And because you have, once you have, I think in anything, once you have the knowledge base, it's very easy then to pick stuff up that's attached to it and, you know, understand where it's coming from. And there was also this amazing program on some channel, and I can't, it, we got a Skybox finally, and...
Mind, Body, and Kick-Ass Moves?
Yeah, that sounds, it had a really silly long title. Yeah, that... Is this guy, is a British guy,
yeah.
And he's all, he talks like that, and, you know, and he sounds like your average pub idiot, you know, but he's incredibly well trained. He's got an amazing level of martial arts skill, and it's basically a program where has anyone else seen this?
Yeah.
Sorry, what was it called?
Mind, Body, and Kick-Ass Moves. I bought it 2 weeks ago. Mind, Body, and Kick-Ass Moves in England, and in America it's Mind, Body, and Kicking Moves.
Ah, right. So as not to offend. Yeah. Yeah. But that was a fascinating show, not least because it was on at like 2 a.m, and you'd sort of come in from a party or something and sort of slump in front of the TV and turn it on. Wow, what's that? And when you're in that really weird receptive mood at 2 a.m. when you've had a couple of drinks, and you sort of wake up the next morning going, wow, that was amazing. Did I really watch that? Was it 3? Yes. And he was fantastic because he not only did he go everywhere and look at every possible martial art you could think of, but he had this really eclectic way of looking at what the styles did. And I still remember there's something in Black Man where there's a bit where those two characters face each other off, and the character who theoretically ought to be the one who would lose just basically convinces the other guy not to start. And he knows that he's been convinced, but he doesn't know how. He just is suddenly aware that maybe he can't win this fight. And he goes, that's very clever, how do you do that? And she just says, practice. and that comes from that program, because he went to, I think, Okinawa, and I think it was Okinawa karate that he was studying, and they had this tiny little, you know, as very often they are, these tiny little Japanese guys, 60 years old or whatever, and the guy just walks towards him, and he's and you've seen this guy breaking bricks and kicking ass all over the place, and he walks in on him, and the guy's just like, whoa, and the right, I don't think, I, and back right off him. And he said to him, I don't know what you did there, but I just, wow, that completely turned the fight. You know, the guy did nothing, you know. So little moments like that, you know, you if you already have the knowledge base, you kind of, you go, God, I've got to buy that, I've got to use that. And that applies not only to the martial arts, it applies to an awful lot of the other stuff. Guns, less so, because I'm not that interested in them. I was a kid, I was a boy, and I used to own a couple of books full of guns, you know. But I've never fired a real gun in my life. But you acquire that knowledge. I think if you're male, you also just have this wiring for acquiring knowledge on, you know, things that kill. So that came in much the same way, I think. But I found the martial arts much more interesting. Oh, another thing was talking to people who've actually been in wars and things like that. Like, I talked to, Joe Haldeman, who, you know, has really been seen and done it, and he had a very interesting observation, which again finds its way into Black Man in a sensibility, in that I was saying, did you get combat training? He was a combat engineer. He wasn't, theoretically wouldn't have been supposed to be fighting, but he was fighting. And I said, so did you get any combat training? He said, oh yeah, they gave us commando training. Two afternoons. And I said, oh right, well that must have been interesting. He said, well, to be honest with you, the instructor just said to me, he said, look, you're going to a war with a gun, okay? And they will have guns on the other side as well. So the chances of you being in a situation where you don't have a gun and the guy you're fighting also doesn't have a gun, he said, that's just really not going to happen very often. Most of the time, he'll have a gun and you don't, you're dead. You have a gun, he doesn't, he's dead. You've got a gun, you'll shoot it out. If, on the very, 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 very unlikely chance that you both end up unarmed, get him on the ground, kick his head in. And it's that brutally simple. He said to me, you're wearing these great big army boots with a steel toe cap. So he said, it's all about, he said, you just get the guy down, when he's on the ground, you kick him in the head. And he said, and that's your fight, the fight is over. He said, all this business about, you know, sort of technique and stuff, forget it. You know. And again, that found its way into Black Man, was that sense that, you know, when all is said and done, it's a lot to do with getting your guy on the ground and kicking him in the head. You know, I don't like violence. I sometimes maybe give the opposite impression. But I'm made very uncomfortable by fiction that sort of revels in it. No, actually, that's wrong. I don't mind the reveling in it. I'm made very uncomfortable by fiction that... what's the word? Honours it, I suppose. I think that's the word, honours it. I think if you're male, and maybe to a lesser extent if you're female, there is a certain amount of reveling in violence, you know, as long as you win. That's a part of the human animal that I don't think you can escape, so I don't have a problem with that. But I do have a problem with fiction that sort of codifies it in such a way as it's seen as a good thing. It's never a good thing. You know, anyone who's ever been involved in violence, whether it be at a military level or policing level or even just, you know, belong to a gang or something like that, has been in prison, they all tell you the same thing. You know, you don't have to hear it many times before it becomes clear. There's nothing good about violence. I try and temper my fascination with slightly more realistic approach. Sorry, did I answer the question? I'm rambling now.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Can I get the guy at the back and look?
When you write some strong sci-fi novels beginning, and then you swap them to the fantasy genre still remains, you give yourself or give the creation, you know, dealing with that risk of swapping genres?
I think we were all aware that there was a certain amount of risk, but the thing is, the fantasy readership is actually larger than the SF readership. So it was kind of a risk that my editor was... It's a risk I'm prepared for you to take. But also, I think we kind of knew, or at least, yeah, I did, and I think he did, that whatever I wrote was not going to be hugely different to what I've been writing, in the sense that, yeah, I mean, Still Remains is a fantasy... Well, actually, I got shoved against the wall and busted for writing science fiction in the Still Remains, but, that's really... It comes down to... individual tastes, I think. I think it's a fantasy novel. So there. But but I, it was pretty clear that although it was going to be different in the sense of being for a different genre, the sensibilities weren't going to be a lot different. And so I think the feeling was most of the people who'd read the SF were probably going to transfer without too much difficulty. With a bit of luck, we'd pull in some fantasy fans who didn't know who the hell I was, and then they might backtrack to my other stuff. So it wasn't seen as a huge risk, really, although the advantage was quite small. I'm not one for genre divisions. I'm really not, and I didn't see it. I didn't feel it that it was a big jump. It felt comfortable. I read a huge amount of fantasy over the years. You know, not so much recently, but I mean, when I was developing my literary tastes, when I was late childhood, early teens, mid teens, so on, I read a huge amount of fantasy then. Possibly more fantasy than science fiction, in fact, at some stages of that process. So it wasn't that I felt it was a place I'd never been. It was, you know, and in some senses it's a place I'm kind of revisiting, a kind of fantasy that I'm told is not as common now anyway. So again, that's quite interesting, because it appears that Still Remains is not like a lot of stuff that's going on at the moment. I'm not making that as a claim, incidentally. I also got busted for claiming that I'm writing something, you know, fresh and genre busting. I'm not. I'm really not. I'm not trying to. But a number of people have said that, oh, this feels like something written way back when, rather than being contemporary with what's being written. But I'm rambling again. No real fear. No.
Something about History Remains, if you kind of start out with a checklist, so these are all the characteristics of a high fantasy novel, just to make sure they all got subverted during the process.
No. Well, a bit. Let me sort of lay out. Excuse me, I'm still a little flurry. Let me lay out how the book came together, and that might cover it. Incidentally, I've got some books here I'm supposed to give away, and I'm supposed to give prizes for questions. So I don't know how we'll do that, but let me think about it. Still Remains was originally three character vignettes. That's all it was. It was the first chapter, the Ringgill vignette, bits of the first Eggar chapter and bits of the Arketh chapter, though they changed quite a bit as I rewrote them. Okay, and that really was all I had. And I went to my editor and I said, all right, look, this is what I've got, and I think, you know, I'd maybe like to have a go at writing a fantasy novel. So he looks at it and he goes, great, yeah, very good. How many books is this? I went, it's a book, I think. And I get this kind of Godfather moment where he looks at me like Marlon Brando and he goes, how many books? So I go, three? Correct. Have a contract, you know. And the nice thing about once you've, you know, broken in, it's a lot easier to get people to let you do crazy things. And so, you know, I was just given this contract to write three books, and I still didn't have any more than those character vignettes. And what was common to the character vignettes, I think, was just this very grubby, unpleasant feel. Because I'm one of the things that I find really scary, and it's not really a genre thing, I find this when in more in sort of general life, is there's a tendency amongst the Western population of Western developed nations to romanticise pre-industrial life, you know. And it takes many, many forms. I mean, there's a New Age form, there's a sort of anti-technological thing. And it's very easy to understand because it's, you know, the technology, it's so relatively new, you know, in terms of the way we live is so non-human compared to almost everything that the human race has experienced so far. And I'm really scared when I hear people saying things like, you know, oh yeah, but this, you know, people who've been to India and come back and say, oh, it's so spiritual there. Yeah. That'll be why they're all starving to death. This idea that in some way, you know, it's the machinery and the science that we've developed that is separating us from our humanity, just not true. So the sense of it what I had was, if this is going to be a world before there's any real technology in the sense of a established canon of scientific knowledge and so forth, if it's going to be a bit like a medieval society, then it's going to be really brutally unpleasant. And to survive with anything like a 20th or 21st century sensibility, you would have to be something quite strange. And that was, again, I've been given busted, put up against the wall for, for deliberately importing gay characters so as to cause a stir. I really didn't do that. But it was just, I had this character and I thought, well, Ringel is going to be Kovacs in this context. But the problem is, a man like Kovacs, right, who comes from the slums, he's essentially scum in social class terms, who, speaks his mind and, tells people off who have rank, that guy's dead, and there's no way to bring him back because we don't have the sleeving technology. So it would have been a really short fantasy novel. You think this is a short fantasy novel? Yeah. It would have been a fantasy pamphlet. So, how is this guy going to survive? How will he get away with his lip, basically? Okay, well, he can be from the noble class. So you make him from the noble class, that's great, because he gets his weapons training and all the stuff that's useful for a warrior. But if he's from the noble class, why the hell would he care? Life would be great for him. So why is he going to care what is happening to other people? The whole concept, enlightenment tendencies, the whole idea that human life has some intrinsic value, that we are in some way equal, these are all things that we've made up very recently. They're not really, we talk about the Greeks, but actually, if you go back and look at what Greek democracy is, amazingly brutal. They had slavery, women were scum, well, except in Sparta, but then it depended which kind of women you were. But anyway, all the things we take for granted as civilizational norms, they're just not there. So why would he give a shit? And that's when I stumbled on the gay thing. It's like, okay, you don't get a choice about your sexuality. This is hardwired in. And if you are scum, by definition of the kind of people you like to have sex with, and there's nothing you can do about it, then you will be an outsider from the moment you become a sexual being. And then suddenly, then I had it. And that was, that became the core of the novel, basically. So there is a lot of subversion going on. You got me, it's a fair cop. But it's because the entire core of the novel is locked into this sense of, how do you become an outsider in a place like this, and the implications of that. So it was not a conscious effort, really. Honestly.
What's the important character from the city?
For me, or
for you and your writing?
For me, I think. God, I don't know. I will. Hang on. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I mean, what I find enjoyable to write, the thing that really sort of lights my fire, is texture. Now, that texture sometimes will be character. It'll be a little thing, a little something completely off the wall about the character. With Ringer, one of the things that came up early on was that he's a snob, and I really liked that. Because it's a quality I hate, I despise, and so having this, my protagonist have this quality was really handy. And so he knows a lot about wine. And is utterly contemptuous of people who don't. That little bit of texture, it's that kind of thing. Now, sometimes that's character, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's something about the tapestry of the world that you're creating. There are little, like one of the things I like about Altered Carbon is there's this aside about the whales, how the whales remember the Martians in some way that's not defined. And I just like that, and the fact that the protagonist, now we're coming back to character, aren't we? The female police officer is named Kristin after a whale scientist, but she really wanted to be called Maria because she was Hispanic and all her friends were called Maria. But it's little bits of texture. That's what I really get the pleasure from, because when you get it right, it feels like it's real. That can come in at any level. I think I've just demonstrated, without necessarily wanting to, that actually maybe it comes in more with character where I'm concerned. Plots, well, most of my life I've liked quite high-speed plots and sort of driven narratives, but I've discovered actually that I like driven writing, and I'm not actually that worried if the plot is going anywhere. I don't mind. That might be an age thing. It may be that as I'm getting older, I'm less concerned that the narrative should be very clearly laid out. But for example, I'm finding a lot of the stuff I'm reading now, like Cormac McCarthy, where the narrative is pretty non-existent, really. I mean, don't know if you've read the Border trilogy. No. Well, I can summarise the plot for you. You know, young man, pissed off, goes to Mexico, has a rough time, comes back, goes again. I mean, there really is in the second novel, The Crossing, which I don't recommend as a starting place for McCarthy. This guy goes off to, you know, gets pissed off, heads off to Mexico. He comes back, and it's very clear McCarthy has no idea what to do with the rest of the novel. So he hangs about in his hometown for a chapter or two, and then he goes back again and has some more rough times. But I find that McCarthy works for me because the writing is very good, and the imagery he paints of Mexico and the borderlands in the you know, sort of the dying age of the cowboys, sort of 1930s, 40s, is very powerful. So I think you do change over time. But what I don't have a lot of patience with is novels. Here's the thing, I think. This is opinion, so, you know, feel free to disagree. I think you can get away with an ambling narrative and things that aren't necessarily very, very clearly laid out if what's going on is interesting. If your protagonist is a guy, a copy editor, living in a small flat in North London and pissed off with life because his girlfriend's left him and he doesn't really know what he should be doing, you know, that's not very interesting. And I do find those kind of novels bore me to tears. But I don't think that's because there isn't a strong narrative. I think that's just because the material there is so anodyne. You know, I live in a flat in a middle class part of town. I don't need to know I don't need to be sort of led through that experience. Character texture, you know, the creation of an alternate reality, you know, something that feels real to you, that you can empathise with. I think those are the things that work for me. Does that answer the question? actually, was that the same?
No, just as one thing that I've really enjoyed about audiobooks is there's this common thread of being very cynical about societies and civilization and where they're going and how they work.
Mm.
Can you talk about that cynicism?
Yeah, I said this in the panel earlier today. My sense of things is that if it's bad news, it's probably true. And I think that's definitely the case with the human condition. And so I think the way society works, you know, and God knows I'm as happy as it's possible to be, I think, as far as the society I live in is concerned. I would certainly not want to live any other time in the past. And I don't think I'd want to live anywhere outside the context of the Western world, really. So it's not that I'm complaining or anything. But, you know, societies really are, at base, a very brutal thing, because what they say is, well, you can play with in this game as long as you understand that you as an individual really don't matter. And if the needs of the group here become, end up being in conflict with your needs, well, then you're toast. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, we've worked hard at beating this. We've got, you know, democratic institutions, the Enlightenment values, all of this stuff. We're trying to create a form of science, if you like, which will beat that. But the truth of the matter is, if you strip everything back, that is really still there underneath. And you see this. I mean, I think we all saw this with the Iraq War. Because no matter what anybody said, no matter how many people came out on the streets, no matter what analysis was provided by men who knew, I mean, this is the other thing, you know, everyone is screaming not to do this, you know, not just the people who don't want to see a war, but also the CIA, MI5, both, you know, the military in Britain and in America saying, no, don't do this, do not do this, and they just did it anyway. And I think there are moments like that where you see the reality of the society that you live in. And we're cushioned from this because the society we live in has understood, finally, that actually small people matter because they're the grains that make up the whole. So I think it's been interesting the difference, the credit crunch this time compared to, you know, 1930s, where, you know, in the 1930s it's like, oh, well, there are a lot of poor people who are going to be in trouble here. You know, whereas now it's like, shit, there's a lot of poor people going to be in trouble and they won't spend money, and that means the dynamo of the economy will run down and then we won't, and Christ, we better do something about this. There's, you know, we've learned, it's not that we've become more moral, I don't think. I think we've just become a little more intelligent where human dynamics are concerned. But, you know, in terms of, I think that there's a huge distance between what's pragmatically sensible really pragmatically sensible rather than, you know, sort of macho pragmatic, and what is moral. Bringing those two together is incredibly hard, even at the best of times. And you will see, you know, when things go bad, that separation will be there. And the one I like to quote, and you guys may know about this, I'm not sure if you do, geographically you're a lot closer anyway, is the Chagos Islanders. Anyone know about the Chagos Islanders? Yeah. Tell us about the Chagos Islanders. Yeah, alright, that's a bit unfair. This is a thing that I picked up originally from a John Pilger article, but it's been in the news generally. But basically what happened was that there are these islands, there's one called Diego Garcia, and there's a sort of surrounding set of atolls in the Indian Ocean, make a really nice military base for long-range bombers. So back in the 60s, the British government, it's British dependency, back in the 60s, the British government decides that they're going to rent this to the Americans, because we do like the Americans, they're our special friends. So they decided that they would just let them move in. Now, the problem was there were about 2,500 people living on these islands. So what the British did basically was ethnically cleanse them. They just took them, they killed their animals, they marched them down to the docks, put them on a ship, sent the ship to, I think, Madagascar, unloaded them on the dock and said, there you go, off you go, fuck off. And it has taken since 1962 or whenever that happened, these people have been through, because they are British citizens, that's the other thing, these are just, they're not just any third world disposables, you know, these people have British passports. It's taken decades and decades and decades of these people fighting through the courts. First couple of times they went, we've not changed culturally enough, and the courts more or less just say, get out of here, you're the wrong colour for us to be worrying about. Finally, in the last 10 or 15 years, the courts have started to sit up and pay attention, and the last couple of times that it's been brought to a British court, the British justice system has done what it should do, it's done what it says on the tin, and said, yeah, this is disgraceful, this is an atrocity, these people should have the right of return. Now, of course, there is a huge American bomber base in Diego Garcia now, and there is no way we will ever, the British I'm talking about, there's no way we will ever do anything to upset the Americans. So there's no way these people are going back. When the High Court found in their favour and said to the British government, said, you must let these people return, the British government, they pulled this number called an order in council. Right, well, order in council, it seems, and I didn't know about this, I'm a British citizen, lived there all my life, right, and I didn't know about this. An order in council is when the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary or a couple of other senior ministers go along to see the Queen and they say, yeah, there's a law and we don't like it, could you just sign here, please? They sign the order in council, bang, the judgment is quashed and they don't have to do anything about it. And they did that, it went back on appeal. They fought it again. They have spent £5 million in the last decade on legal fees to fight this, to stop these people being allowed to return home. And they've just thrown it out again. It went to the Lords, and the Lords caved in ignominiously and said, oh, well, you know, national interests, etc., etc. And they're screwed, and they're going to the European Court. And for me, it'll be fascinating because the European Court has no particular liking for the British government. We might see a real clash. But the truth of the matter is these people are never going home because the Americans have a base there and the British will not do anything to upset the Americans. The American Secret Service can come to Britain, take away our citizens, fly them to another country, torture them, make them disappear, and the British will do nothing about it. And that's the pragmatic reality I'm talking about. And so I say, I think cynical tends to be the wrong word. I think it's just seeing things in an undarnished fashion, you know. I think it's important that we all try to see things that way, because, as I say, when these crunches do come, if there's enough public pressure, sometimes turn the wheel a little bit. Did that get it?
Yeah.
I think you had your hand up first, didn't you? Yeah, sorry, down the beard.
Sorry, am I correct that you had sold or going to sell AltoCarbon?
AltoCarbon has been in option now since it was published. And basically what happens is every 18 months, Joel Silver comes along and comes along and says, so look, we're not ready to make this film yet. Could we just give you a big check? And the answer to that is, you know, well, let me think. So yeah, what's happening is that it's in renewal. It was renewed in February, that's just gone, for another year in this case. And the rumours come and go like the wind. You know, there was a rumour at one point that Ridley Scott would be directing it. There was a rumour that you know, they had to rewrite the whole script. There was a rumour that Michael Mann might be involved. There was another rumour that oh, several. I've seen one. So it's ongoing. And there was an article in the LA Times where they were saying, you remember the writer's strike was on? And they said, in the event that the writer's strike really gets bad, here are the projects that the studios are prioritising. And Walter Cotton was sitting in a group of about seven or eight for Warner Brothers. So it's getting there, I think. But, you know, could be another 5 years, 10 years, who knows, you know. They might hand it back, you know, they really might. At the end, next year, they might turn around and say, you know what, can't really make a good film out of this. Thanks very much, you know. And I will say, it's no problem, just great doing business with you. does that get it, yeah? Thanks.
Yeah. Have you ever written, or thought about doing a plot so complicated you've actually confused yourself as to where it's...
actually all of them to some extent. I do tend to write open-ended, which means that the plot will set out and things will be dragged in as and because I think they're interesting or because they suggest themselves. The characters get out of hand and suddenly sprout, you know, a brother or a drug problem or something like that. And very, very often those little bits and pieces are the things that become most interesting about the book. And then, yeah, there comes the point when you're 300 and something pages in and it's like, really going to start putting this together. Sorry?
Is that around 20 chapters for the
page? Yeah, it sounds about right.
Do you want to revise what I'm writing then?
Oh, well, no, this is me. I mean, it may work for you. There are as many ways to write a book as there are people who write them. I mean, it's you know, there's no hard and fast rules. But, no, very often I find myself, if not actually confused, then just saying, how the hell am I going to make this make sense? And, you know, there are critics, especially on Amazon, who think that I haven't. So, but, yeah, it does happen.
This is sort of the previous question in that not as a criticism, but the theme of very, very, very strong frame that crops up in just in passing in some of the books or as a core theme in others of heavily anti-religious.
Oh, right, yeah.
Then in whether it's the Catholic and all the Catholic or Jesus Land or without spoiling it, I think just the things that we mentioned early on and stuff. I presume in some cases it was very intentional in time, but the fact that it's cropped up in almost all the books, is it just sort of it accidentally cropped up or are you
just rage, yeah. I find I would say what tends to define my protagonist is, because a number of people have said they're not especially likeable, what they tend to be is quite clear-sighted. And I think, you know, as far as I hope I'm not going to offend anyone here, but, yeah. Religion to me is the ultimate lack of clear-sightedness. It is the ultimate sort of, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and believe what I want to believe rather than what the world tells me makes sense. And as we've seen in recent years, it's one of the biggest obstacles we have to making progress. And even in a very, very cut and dried scientific way, there's a great website. I urge you to visit this. There's a bunch of guys at the University of Virginia, and some of them are now on the west coast of America as well. It's a website called www.yourmorals.org. Has anyone been there? No? You have?
Yeah.
Fascinating piece of work. What these guys... basically, it's a bunch of questionnaires that you can fill out and they'll tell you what kind of person you are. But there are a bunch of links to papers that they've written. And what they're basically saying is that there are... five modules of morality, or let's say, five modules of behaviour governance in the way the human mind works. And the problem you have between liberals and conservatives, basically, is that liberals operate off the first two, And conservatives operate, if you're charitable, they operate off the whole five. If you're not charitable, they operate off the back three. And this guy is basically saying, I found him because there was an article in Prospect magazine about Obama, and saying how if Obama really means what he says about trying to sort of re-knit society in America, he's going to have to take this into account. So the five are, the first one is harm. You know, we're hardwired to feel the pain of others because we have children, because we live in social groups, so we don't like harm. Second thing is justice. We seem to have an innate sense of fairness, which again will probably come from being a sort of a tribal bartering group. You do favours for people, they do favours for you, and you know, we share that with vampire bats, I think. They'll feed each other blood if one's had a rough night and hasn't caught anything, then the other one will feed them blood, but they remember the ones who fed them, and you know, so forth. So there's this innate sense of fairness as well. Now, it would appear that liberals work mostly off those two nuclei, if you like, harm and fairness. You know, we don't like to see people hurt, and we think that the hurting should be spread out fairly. I'm bastardising a bit, but now the other three, these are the ones. Remember that, and they're trying really hard. I mean, these guys are obviously liberals themselves; they admit that they're trying really hard to be sensitive and even-handed here. But they're saying the other three are in-group loyalty, right? So, you know, whatever your tribal unit is, that's you're loyal to them, whatever. Respect for authority figures. So, you know, whoever's bossing you, you do what they say. And a lovely one, the last one, I think it's absolutely beautiful pairing, disgust stroke spirituality. I just think it's beautiful. And what this is, but disgust stroke spirituality is the one that one of the papers is most predicated on, because he says, these are the things where you just have a revulsion for something and that's it, you're not going to discuss it. And they said, imagine that your neighbour has put up a sign saying, cable TV will end civilization. You know, and you go and talk to him and you say, what's this all about? Yeah, the waves that cable TV puts out, you think it's safe, but it's not. In fact, they emanate this force and it's rotting society. Then you can section that woman. But if she puts up a sign saying, God hates fags, then, well, no, you can't section her, because suddenly, you know, this is a valid opinion. And it's like, what he's saying is this, it's where people have a disgust or revulsion for something, for behaviour or something, and they couch it in terms of, this is what God doesn't like. Yeah. Or, conversely, the things that God does like. You know? And what occurred to me, and I don't think they've done this accidentally, is that as you track across those five, you get further and further from objective reality. So the first one, harm, you know, if I break my leg, no one's going to argue about that. You know, they might say I deserved it, but fundamentally, a broken leg is a broken leg. The second one, justice. Justice is a shaky thing, but it is the best shot we've had at trying to make things objective, trying to see a situation in an objective fashion. You know, yeah, I know you're pissed off, but on the other hand, you did spill his beer, and so forth. So you're sort of close to reality there if you operate the system well. Okay, third one, in-group loyalty. Blam! It's gone! You know, if you are loyal to your group, and it doesn't matter what your group do, so your just chances of justice, harm's bad as long as it's harm that's happening to my in-group. So you're immediately pulling away from any attempt to view the world objectively. When you get to leadership, it's even worse, because by definition, we all know this, power corrupts. So people who are in charge, most of the time, will be doing the wrong thing. Unless they're regulated, unless they're controlled, they will get out of hand. So a tendency in the human brain to respect what people with power say is catastrophically bad news. You know, it's further and further from reality. By the time you get to disgust and spirituality, man, that's it, it's over. You know, because if you're going to say, well, I think we should do X, Y, and Z, why? Well, because God says so. You know, and that's the argument. So that's it, you're done. You know, there's no hope for building any kind of functioning, decent society, if that's your tenet. And I had an interesting experience once when I was still teaching at Strathclyde University, when I had a student who'd come over to do operational research, I think. He was basically working for an oil company, and they're the guys who plan the plants. You know, okay, how much oil's coming in, what bore of pipeline do we need, how do we route it through the plant, what's the security issues, and so forth. He'd come to do a master's in this. And we were training him up using the IELTS system, the English language training system. So one of the things you do is you get people to argue pro and con something. you know, in English. So they set you up with something really simple because the guy's English wasn't great. And it was about animals, use of animals. And the essay was, how did it go? Humans should not use animals for their purposes unless the well-being of the animal in question can be assured. I mean, they deliberately pick something you can argue both sides of, you know. So I said to him, all right, we're going to go through this, we're going to look at... He was from Libya, I forgot to mention. We're going to go through this and we're going to look at the pros and cons. So I sent him away to have a think about it, and he came back to the next lesson. I said, okay, so, you know, can we use animals then? What about that? He goes, oh, yes. Right, and why? Oh, my God, says it is good. Right, well, all animals. Oh, no. The pig, my God says, the pig you cannot use. And so I said, well, other animals. Yes, other animals you can use, yes. And I'm thinking, how is this guy going to do a master's in operational research? You know, yes, the pipeline will go here and it will be this wide. Why? Well, my God says so. You know, this is where my problem with religion comes from, is it's such... a catastrophic shying away from, you know, how reality is. But I find it very hard to give it any take it seriously. And I mean, in Black Man, I really tried. I, you know, create a character who actually did have some religious feelings and pretty much loses them. But sorry, did that answer the question? I think that's
pretty much except just it doesn't affect the follow up, which was organized. If the problem is just organized religion, which a lot of it seems to be going against, or if it's just religion in general, or spirituality in religion as well.
I think organized religion is the problem in the sense that once religion is organized, it becomes powerful. It's able to do things. I think if people were, I mean, it's like the woman with her sort of cable TV will rot civilization. There are a lot of individuals who believe really weird stuff, but generally, as long as they are individuals, it's not a problem. And in fact, my Spanish editor has this theory about the United States. He says the reason they've got problems, he said, in most countries, if you have some weirdo bunch of ideas, then you'll get, you know, people will just not kick you into touch. They said in America, no matter how weird your ideas are, you'll probably be able to find a little group of people who will share them with you. And then you'll set up a website, and then you'll form a political party. And he said, and you'll be validated. You know, you say, I'm not the only one who thinks that the moon is made of cheese. And yes, I think that's the problem. The organisation is not that it's any less, sort of more stupid than the thing itself, is that once it becomes organised, it becomes dangerous. It's scary. But it's not just religion. I mean, you see this with politics. Extreme politics is very similar. Communism, fascism, it's exactly the same mindset. Yeah. Sorry, are we out of time?
Getting
last few minutes, last question. Oh, shit. Okay, so interesting questions, and I'll give a book away to each person who comes up with one. Yeah.
Caveman versus astronaut.
Sorry?
Caveman versus astronaut.
Well, that's definitely worth a book. It depends on the context. I guess in outer space, astronauts. in a cave, less so. Yeah. Sorry, which one do you want? Which book do you want?
Ultra Carbon.
Right, okay, so that's for you. You come and get it. I'll sign it up here.
Mark,
for...
I don't
want
to... Longer or shorter? I kind of read it, and a lot of your early books have been really big on substantial and longer.
Yeah.
And now you've gone off to write long fantasy novels, although apparently they started very, very short.
Yeah.
And I read Mark of Forces and thought, you kind of felt like you were either a shorter book in disguise or potentially a much longer book in disguise.
Well, it was originally a short story. And then it became a screenplay based on the short story, and the novel was novelization of the screenplay. In that sense, it's probably the only time I ever have written to a sort of fixed thing, and maybe that's why it's shorter. But it's also the book where you can see what's going to happen from page three. And I didn't like that. I mean, some people minded, others didn't, but what was very clear is, like, yeah, you know what's going to happen. So my response, my get out was, but it's Shakespearean. but I didn't like the fact it was so predictable. So, in a sense, that's why I've not done that again. Yeah.
How do you feel about the stories that they publish on the internet?
Which stories are they?
Internet stories that they publish on the internet. A lot of them are fan fiction. But how do you feel about that in general?
Fan fiction. I... I don't mind fan fiction. I mean, it's, I guess it's the ultimate form. I don't know if anyone does fan fiction of my stuff. Hope so. It's the ultimate form of flattery, I suppose, that someone is imitating your stuff. But I'm just a bit confused by the people who do it, because I'm thinking, I would not be prepared to put in the time and effort and talent into producing something that has no hope of, you know, being published or you know, there's no payback for it for me. So I don't really understand the mindset, but I mean, you know, I've got nothing against it.
The definition of humanity, does it apply to humans, or is your subversive sort of view of it more reality?
I'm not sure I understood that, so you're getting this one. Sorry, could you go do that one again?
Basically, how everyone says humanity is this set of values which are all rumored to be upheld, very romanticized.
Yeah.
People aren't really like that. So would it be, would you say that anyone is really under the definition of humanity, or would a subverted view be more?
Well, I think what really matters is to view humanity realistically, because once you view it realistically, it's like anything. You can see what it will and won't do, you know, where its strengths lie, how best to use it. You know, I'm hiring a car to go up the West Coast after this con, and basically I hired a 4x4 because someone said to me, well, you know, a lot of this is, the roads are not sealed, and there's some, you know, the interesting things are very often in places that are harder to get to and so forth. So a 4x4 suits that. It would be stupid of me to own a 4x4 where I live in Glasgow. You know, and in a similar way, humanity works in, you know, the big problem we've got with our leaders is they're trying to run humanity from a manual for something else. You know, so they're leaping through and saying, oh, we'll do this because then that should happen. It's like, no, that's not humanity. That's some bullshit that was made up by a bunch of people who believe in God. You know, that's not how humans behave. You know, so I think it's a question of just being honest with ourselves. It's very hard to do. I mean, it sounds simple, but even being honest with yourself as an individual is hard. And to be honest with ourselves about, you know, the race is really tough. But I think it can be done with a modicum of maturity. That's yours for. Yeah?
Is there any instance where a character you've been working with, or a plot line that you have been working with, have actually taught you something about yourself that startled or unsettled you, you know, gone into the subversive?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Black Man. One of the things that I was sort of mining was the idea of this sort of the black man as a threat in American consciousness, and what I actually found was he's a threat to me too. I found out why I don't like hip-hop videos, and you know why I don't like hip-hop videos? Because they're basically full of these big black guys surrounded by women, you know, and it's like, no, those should be for me. And I found out that whole psychosexual horror of the big black man, which is so very clearly on display in American society, I think there is, unfortunately, there's a little bit of that in every male human being. Yeah, oh, except the black guys, obviously. And yeah, I mean, when I went to Kenya for a holiday, and it's just unnerving because, you know, black men just seem, you know, better designed. They're generally bigger. They look better. They, you know, most women I know will admit to a strong attraction to them. And so I kind of learned a little bit about my own thinking. Oh, yeah. And of course, when you find out that you yourself suffer from the thing that you're criticizing, then it gives you much more energy to go in there and attack it. So that's definitely the case. Wow, you're getting. I think you can have the self knowledge one. So that's for you. Yeah.
Yeah, do you ever find when you're developing your characters, that consciously or subconsciously, you use someone you've met or an incident and form from there without realizing you're doing it?
Yes, very much. Market Forces has a couple of moments in it that I actually experienced. There's a bit where he's on secondment in the Middle East, and a woman brings him fruit because he's staying in her village. That actually happened to me in Eastern Turkey. Was a very moving experience. I'd still tear up when I think about that now. So that's for you. We've got time for two more questions. Guy right at the back. This one.
Okay.
This is going to sound really seedy, but my favourite is always the last one I wrote. Because you like to think you get better over time, and generally speaking, I think I have. The books have different strengths and weaknesses, but usually the last one that I've done is the one where I can look at it and go, oh, you're much better at this now, you know, you're doing this better. So I would say, but that's not a recommendation, because if you don't like fantasy, you're not going to like it. If you like SF, I would start with Altered Carbon. If you like everything. Yeah, I would start with Altered Carbon, and then I'm going to give you this. So now you have to buy and read Altered Carbon, because this one won't make sense otherwise. You come down and collect that after. Yeah. One more question. No, you've had two or three from you. Yeah. Yes. No, I write as near as I can work out, because it's not an easy thing to pin down. I write for myself. Every book I've written, and I say this is thanks to Joel Silver, basically. I haven't had to worry about market. Every book I've written has been the book I wanted to read. And I'm one of these guys who started writing when I was a kid still, literally because I was trying to create the stuff that I liked to buy from bookshops and didn't have the money to buy any more of. So I'm writing for myself. The fact that I can sell the books is just great, but it's not why I do it. Does that cover that? Okay, so you're the last question, so this is for you. Come and get it. Sorry, I run way over there, but thanks very much.